You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Once again tonight, I'm pleased, in conjunction with the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association, to present a show so big it takes us two hosts. Co-hosting the show with me tonight, Rob Wyman, a certified workers' compensation law specialist from the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California.
Good evening, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Tonight, we discuss new laws reshaping the gig economy. In the studio with Rob and I tonight, our guests, labor and employment attorneys, Thomas Lenz, a partner at Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo. You're so polite, you've never corrected me when I get the names wrong.
You said it perfectly.
Out of Pasadena, California. And from here in San Francisco, Christian Schreiber, a partner in Olivier, Schreiber, and Chow in San Francisco.
Thanks for having me tonight.
Tonight, there's much to discuss. If you have questions for Rob's and my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 in the studio. If you're outside of the local dialing area that's outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. If you want us to pick up the freight, call us on our 866 number, 866-798-8255. Occasionally, I may neglect to mention that while we're happy to answer all questions, we stop short of giving precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case. We're more than happy to pass along the legal principles that can help guide your decision-making. And as always, you can call regarding any question. Tonight on the topic of employment law, and especially as it relates to the gig economy, you're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And again, the toll-free number here is 866-798-8255. With that, Chris, Tom, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Happy to be here.
Before we go any further, I'd like to start with where we are with the change in the laws that's happened recently and to what extent they're reshaping the gig economy.
Well, but I'm going to jump in for a second. We're really here to discuss those new laws and to what extent they're reshaping the gig economy. But just what is the gig economy?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. The gig economy is probably easiest to think about as short-term employment. And I think the term gig sometimes makes it sound sexier than it actually is. It's really freelance work or short-term employment, and it's really marked by that more than anything. It's spans a range of jobs. It can be a driving job, but historically, these are jobs that are freelance in nature, whether it's artistic or babysitting even, things like that. But what has marked the gig economy in recent years has just been the expansion and growth and use of technology to place workers into these short-term jobs.
As a layperson, when it comes to this field, I'm pretty much a layperson. I've always envisioned the gig economy as something where everything you do, it's like a whole new job starting over. You may be giving somebody a ride, and each ride is like a new job, in a matter of speaking. Is that a fair and accurate depiction, do you think?
I think that that's how the hiring entities want it to be framed, that this is something where you perform a job. It's a widget. When you finish that job, you're done. And theoretically, they may believe that you are free to go to work for someone else to do the same thing or something different for someone else. But I think in the reality of these situations, and I think as many of us practitioners see on a regular basis, the individuals that raise legal issues are often doing the same sorts of things over and over for the same hiring entity or let's just say business. And the more and more it occurs, the more dependent an individual or a group of people become on a company or app or whatever it might be, the more likely it is there is a long-term relationship to be interpreted from that.
I'd agree with what Tom said. I guess I would just, you know, ask the questioner the same question back, which is, what job isn't sort of a repeat of doing the same thing over and over? And it's true that while you may drive a passenger, for example, and that ends your relationship with that passenger on a given ride, if you pick up another passenger, your job is basically doing the same thing again. And I don't know how that distinguishes it in any meaningful way, at least legally, from a job in which, let's say, you're teaching. You know, every day you go to work, you teach first graders. Your job is the same, and it's the one day ends or a new class graduates, you're still performing a job.
And I guess the real question, in the way I framed it and the way you're framing it, is who you work for. And that's going to have a lot to do with the paradigm you're working under.
That's correct. I think many times when issues arise with the gig economy, there is an individual who might believe that he or she is an employee because of control, who has control over the work, as opposed to being in an independent business, setting yourself out in the marketplace as an operation that is going to serve customers in a way that you choose to do it, not in the way someone tells you how to do it.
So whereas some of these entities might have wanted to perceive it like you're working for individuals and they're just a platform, the employers, or maybe in the case of the drivers, are feeling like, no, I work for the entity. They get a piece of it. I work for them. And these are their consumers I'm servicing, not my consumers.
I think that's correct. If you have an individual who says, I have to do it this way, I have to do what they tell me, historically there has been a degree of control. There's a lot of different factors that have come into play, but the more control a hiring entity, a business has over the individual actually doing the work, that's where, you know, the law has, you know, been more inclined to find an employee-employer relationship rather than one that is a business with another business.
I think that's right. If you consider, for example, what it looks like to get into a vehicle that's operated by one of the ride-sharing companies, for example, the vehicles are branded. Now, for many drivers, for example, might be wearing the uniform of the business that they're driving for. That's another marker of control. If there's no real ability to obtain customers in any manner other than through, for example, an app or through the intermediary, as they like to consider themselves, then really what you're seeing is sort of a demarcation point between an employer and an independent contractor. I think the classic way to think about it is, if you operate a store and you're selling, you know, blue jeans, let's say, and the pipes break in the employee bathroom, you hire a plumber, you're not in the plumbing business. The person comes in, they fix the pipes, and they're on their way. That is a classic independent contractor situation.
I always thought that was a key distinction when I would speak to my clients who would come to see me about a work injury and questioning whether they're truly an independent contractor. I'd ask them, well, what do you do and what does your purported employer do? Are you in a different... And the plumbing example is the one I would give. When my pipe breaks, I hire a plumber. He's not my employee. We're in a totally different line of work. I always started with that one.
I think that's right. I mean, the plumber shows up as and when he sees fit. He does the work as and when he sees fit. He uses his own tools, et cetera. He comes and he goes.
Now, we're soon to talk about a recent Senate bill that passed and has been signed into law. But before we get there, I understand there was some recent case law that really determined how we could figure whether someone's an employee or whether they're a contractor.
Yes, the Supreme Court of California, a little over a year ago, in a ruling which, depending on who you're talking to, it's either called Dynamex or Dynamics. And in that case, they established a new test, or new to California, for independent contractor status, which is referred to as the ABC test. California had used a test under another court case called Borrello, which relied heavily on control and a number of other factors, the control that we spoke about a moment ago. ABC test basically requires an employer to or an alleged employer to satisfy a three-factor test. So that will determine whether or not someone is an employee or an independent contractor. But the presumption is, under that analysis, the ABC test, that the individual is an employee until proven otherwise.
The thing I'd add to that is that the Dynamics case that was decided by the California Supreme Court, and that decision came down in April of 2018, the ABC test, it clarified what California law is. This is an attempt by the court to simplify the understanding of what it means to be an employee versus an independent contractor. And those three tests are intended to provide clarity to workers and to businesses and to anybody who has the question about whether or not the work I'm doing is the work of an employee. And it's probably helpful just to talk about what those three prongs are. The A test is the traditional one that Tom mentioned, which is the worker free from the control of the hiring entity? And so the control test is sort of how we think about it when we're representing clients. Does the worker have the ability to come and go as they choose? Can they work sort of whenever they want? And are they using their own, the law calls them instrumentalities, but are their own tools and things like that to perform the work? That's the A test. The B test is whether the worker's performance is outside the scope of the hiring entity's business. And so that's the plumbing example. If you're in the business of selling blue jeans, you're not in the plumbing business, and it's very easy to distinguish the type of work that the worker is doing from what you do. And then the C test is, it's a question of whether the worker is customarily engaged in an independently established trade, business, or occupation. And you can see, in particular, in the B and the C prongs of the test, that these get to be a little bit gray when you're talking about drivers, for example, who are working for ride-sharing platforms. What is the business of the ride-sharing platform? There are two large ones in California, I think everybody knows. But are they in the business of transporting passengers, or, as they suggest, are they merely technology companies? I mean, I have a very strong opinion about that, but I would say that the drivers are employees under the B prong, and under the C prong, unless they're holding themselves out in some capacity as a driving company.
One of the things that's always struck me is the number of cars that you see that have both logos simultaneously. They'll have them one over the other. Does that do anything, do you think, to compromise their position? I mean, if they're doing the same work for multiple entities, does that change the look about whether they're working for one or the other?
I can see employers making the argument that that shows that there's no exclusivity, there's no reliance exclusively upon one of those entities. But I think that by the same token, someone can be an employee of more than one entity, and I think that cuts both ways.
Yeah, if you've ever had two jobs, and I dare say there are a lot of people out there who have, including myself, there's no reason to believe that you need only be employed by one entity and then you're an independent contractor for others.
Where I imagine it gets more complicated is when you have somebody working with these rideshare apps that have two cell phones, two iPhones side by side mounted up there, ready to jump to whichever one comes. It gets a little murky.
Yeah, that's very possible. And I've talked to people who who drive for these apps, as I'm sure many people have. And I know that sometimes they like to turn one off or turn the other off, or they go back and forth depending upon their preference. But still, you know, they are subject to you know, whatever requirements that are imposed upon them as a result of doing that work.
Yeah, there's a term of art in the industry for that. They call it multi-homing, and certainly it is true that the rideshare companies believe that that's indicative of an independent contractor status. I'm dubious myself. I think the reality is that, and I think this is an important point to sort of ground ourselves in at all times, which is there's a reason why they're switching back and forth. You know, they're trying to maximize their profitability, perhaps. But I think we have to keep in mind that the difference in terms of what they're actually able to generate in the way of, you know, an advantage is still extraordinarily nominal, maybe a matter of pennies on an hourly basis. I don't think that's particularly competitive on their part.
I had a question about the C test, the independent business test. Before we went on the air, we talked about some old school jobs where this issue arose, truck drivers. Some of them own their own trucks. They advertise that they will haul things for other people. Some lease trucks from a shipping company and only work for them. They're frequently classified as independent contractors. How do you compare the old sort of school truck business with what we're seeing today in rideshare?
I think that, you know, it's really just a new chapter of a sort of arrangement that's existed over time. And I mean, we see technology change. We see that there are new ways to access a particular product or service, but it's the same sort of dynamic playing out over and over, where you have you know, different arrangements and that are set up. And in the case of the truck drivers, you may very well have someone who purchases or finances a vehicle, and you know, may offer services to a number of people, or may be heavily dependent upon one entity, one business, for the work that he or she does. So it's I think that the issues are very much the same. It's just the way in which they arise can be different, and how someone holds themselves out. It may depend upon, you know, just their level of sophistication in terms of either setting up a business or aligning with an app or other operation.
Yeah, this sort of, to me, it harkens to an old saying, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, and I think that's true here. What was customary 25 years ago now has the veneer of technology, and so it's being reintroduced to us with this idea that these are new arguments, or that the time to evolve requires us to leave behind these important social portions of our important tenets of our social contract. And you know, I've represented truck drivers, and the thing that comes to mind in responding to your question is that the trucking company that we were up against, they were leasing the vehicles back to our class members. And at the time they were hired, they were asked to sign paperwork establishing a business, and they were given, you know, documents to sign, to send in to the Secretary of State, so that Joe Smith's hiring procedure became the creation of Joe Smith Trucking Inc. And that was really just a scheme for the employer to avoid turning these workers into employees. And I think you always have to ask the question, you know, what is the motivation there? And it's certainly economic. I think exclusively for the employers. But there's a giant loss on the part of the workers, and I know we'll probably touch on this later, but you know, being an independent contractor has immediate and long-term very serious consequences for workers, which is why this fight is so heavily engaging on the part of our workforce.
And I do want to discuss the social impact that this is going to have, but for now I'd like to remind our listeners that they are listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Rob Wyman. Next week we'll be looking at the nuts and bolts of the congressional investigations underway that might lead to impeachment. But back here in the present, we are discussing employment law and the gig economy. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255.
And with that, let me turn it over to Pam in San Mateo. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you. I'm kind of confused here. So I have been a full-time employee of a company, and I never really got to set my own hours. I couldn't decide, you know, to come in late one morning and stay late, or come in early and leave early. I couldn't decide that I'm not going to work Wednesday this week, I'm going to work Saturday instead. I couldn't tell them that, hey, I'm taking 2 weeks off and going off on vacation next week and expect that I would have a job when I got back, okay? And I sure as heck couldn't have decided that, well, you know, things are pretty slack here right now, so I'm just going to pop down the street and work for my company's competitor. So it seems like you really kind of got a hybrid situation, don't you? You know, they're really not fish or fowl, these gig employees, particularly the folks who drive for Uber and Lyft. So can you clarify that for me, how they qualify as employees with all of those differences from what normally would be considered employment?
Sure. Just to be clear, you weren't suggesting that you were an independent contractor when you were...
No. I'm saying that I was an employee and that I would not have remained an employee had I done what these people that you're describing as employees can do.
Well, I guess what the simplest way to respond to your question is to say that the control that your employers exercised over you quite clearly made you an employee.
Right,
and
absolutely.
So when you apply this ABC test, the first question is, well, is there control being exerted by the employer over the employee? And certainly the Ubers and the Lyfts and the DoorDashes and other companies that are relying on drivers suggest that they don't have that level of control. And I think that's a closer question than they would suggest. The rides, for example, are highly regulated. The nature of the car, the level of insurance, the routes that are suggested, all of those things are elements of control.
Uh-huh. Now, but a suggestion is a lot different than you will be here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning and you will work until 5:30 with a half an hour for lunch between 1 and 1:30.
Well, that is one way in which an employer can exercise control. But I think one of the things that has been sort of put out there by gig economy businesses is to suggest that all employers have to exercise that level of control. And I would take issue with the idea that employers are required to be inflexible with their workforce. For example, your employer determined that they wanted you to work Monday through Friday from 9 to 5 with a half an hour lunch. There's nothing in the law that suggests that that employer could have given you the opportunity to execute on your projects on Saturday or Sunday, or not on Wednesday, or from 10 to 7. So depending on the nature of the work, it's entirely possible that an employer could offer the kind of flexibility that to an employee that you're claiming is sort of a mark of an independent contractor status. I think the other really important thing here is under this California Supreme Court case, and particularly under prong B of the ABC test, the question that courts ask is the work merely incidental to the business, or is it integral? And that's an economic question to some extent. So if you're talking about a ride-sharing company, for example, how do they make money but for the labor of the drivers who are actually doing the driving for the company? Now, that's a question that I guess, you know, your work may not have been integral, or the work of an employee may not be integral in quite the same way in order for someone to be an employee. For example, at Intel or at a high-tech company, you can be an employee for the control factors that you're identifying, even if you're doing a job that's not essential to the company's profits. So those are the reasons that, in spite of the flexibility that you're identifying, in spite of that, that's not the determinative factor.
And what about the idea of working for a competitor?
Well, I don't know that that has ever been dispositive or determinative of whether you're an employee. For example, if you worked at McDonald's on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and you worked at Burger King on Tuesdays and Thursdays, in theory, you're working for a competitor. And that's not something that the law has precluded. Now, employers may have taken steps to prevent you from doing so, but that in and of itself is not a basis for saying that you're either an independent contractor or an employee. Much like a plumber might fix the pipes at a Coca-Cola plant and then fix the pipes at a Pepsi plant.
Yeah, but we already agreed that they're independent contractors. I get that.
One of the things that I think Pam is commenting on is pretty pervasive in our economy today, in that a lot of employers, much less those that are using the services of contractors, many of them are moving away from a more traditional model where you're coming into work at a certain time of day and staying through the day. And so many of them, while remaining employers, have brought in such changes as flex time, job sharing, telecommuting, and working from home in ways that would never have been thought of a generation or so ago.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's been a trend as well toward outsourcing, perhaps hiring a subcontractor to do certain types of work. The traditional degrees of control, which Pam talks about, are fairly common in the workplace with many, many jobs. But I think many of the entities, particularly in recent years, have been trying to maybe loosen that control, but it still raises questions under the other factors, which is why this analysis is so detail-driven when we're looking at that distinction between an employee and an independent contractor.
Okay. Thanks very much. I think I got it.
Great. Pam, thanks for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Okay,
thanks, Pam.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden with Rob Wyman, and next week we'll be back looking at the nuts and bolts of the congressional investigations underway that might lead to impeachment. But back in the here and now tonight, we're talking about employment law and particularly looking at the gig economy. That, to a lot of us, may mean the drivers that pick us up when we can't go somewhere in our own cars for whatever reason. But it's way broader than that. We're going to bring that in. It might be the person doing your hair. It might be the person working on your house. We're talking about the gig economy. If you have questions from my guests, and my guests in the studio tonight are both employment attorneys, we have Thomas Lenz, from a partner with the firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo in Pasadena, and Christian Schreiber, partner at the firm of Olivier, Schreiber, and Chow in San Francisco. There's a lot to discuss here, and if you have questions from my guests, call us at our number in San Francisco, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And again, that's 866-798-8255. You're not limited to where we are in our discussion. You don't even have to have a question on the gig economy. If you have an employment law question, call us. We have experts in the field right here to take your calls. And again, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. So we learned a little bit about that decision. Does that bring us in line with other states, or are we on a different page once again where California's kind of going in a different direction and hopefully leading?
California took a position which I think is typical of California, being out in front as a leader in a new approach to things. But California adopted a legal standard that came out of the state of Massachusetts. And it is a standard which has received attention in other places, other states as well. It is also an approach which is now receiving attention on Capitol Hill. There is legislation which is looking at implementing the ABC test. And that's a bill called the PRO Act. It's the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which was put forth by Senator Bernie Sanders.
Does it seem to be getting any traction?
It has supporters, but I don't see it passing in the current administration.
That would put it in fine company with lots of other progressive legislation.
Yeah, I would wonder about the current Senate leadership if it would ever get any floor time and even discussion.
I think that's unlikely.
So after this case was decided, I understand that there is some legislation pending.
Actually, legislation that was enacted in California pursuant to the ruling in Dynamics, the ABC test, and it is AB 5, which Governor Newsom signed on September 18. And as a matter of law, in the California books, the statutes that cover all of the employers in the state of California, you have the ABC test put forth to cover claims under the labor code. You have it also covering unemployment claims, and after a while, it will also cover workers' compensation.
One of the things I noticed in the legislation is, unlike the case law, it specifically included and excluded certain types of, I won't say professions, because some of the stuff may be professions in the sense that it requires a license, but many of us wouldn't think of these as skilled positions or skilled professions, but they're in or out. From the lay perspective, it looks almost randomly.
There is a patchwork, and I think part of the work of interpreting this statute is going to be sorting out what is exempt from AB 5 and what is not. And I mean, some of the things are categorical in terms of types of work. Other things are categorical in terms of types of relationships, business to business, or in the construction industry, certain contracting relationships. So there's going to be a lot of detail-driven questions. And even if you're not subject to the ABC test because of an exemption, you could be subject to an independent contractor analysis under the pre-existing Borrello standard, which was mentioned. So you're not quite out of the woods, even if you're not covered by ABC.
Let me turn it to Ruthie in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hello. I am a psychotherapist, and I contract with insurance companies. to see psychotherapy patients, and I'm wondering how this law will affect that.
There is an exemption from the ABC test for doctors, and I think the details are going to matter in terms of your relationships with those that you serve. But even if the ABC test does not apply to you, the Borrello standard may apply to you, which looks more to control and a number of other factors.
Yeah, there are other.
Even though I'm not a doctor in the terms of an MD, I'm still considered would be covered under doctors.
Well,
I'm an MFT, marriage family therapist.
I just note that there are cases around the country, including a case that comes to mind from Massachusetts, where this standard was adopted, in which they've distinguished between the business of an insurance company and what the nature of the product and or the service that the insurance company is providing and the nature of the service that you're providing. So whether you'd be exempt under the ABC test or under Assembly Bill 5 that was recently enacted, it seems likely, without knowing all your facts, that you'd be offering a service different than what an insurance company making referrals to you is offering.
And what,
Yeah.
Okay.
But I can think
of
a whole host of questions that Ruthie brings up. Ruthie, while you're on the line, I could think of a number of things.
Yeah.
If, for example, this insurance company provided the facility and sent all their people to you and had somebody there to schedule them and you worked within their building, and they're like, I would think that that would look a whole lot different to me than if you're putting in an insurance claim to them and other insurers and are seeing people independently.
Right. That makes sense. There is one organization. I have my own office, but they send the people to me, and I have to use their forms and the way that, you know, they want me to do it in that sense. So it is their clients that I see, but in my own office. Yeah.
Yeah, the details always matter on these, and just to drill down a little bit, some of the people that are excluded from the ABC test, and just digging deeper, licensed healthcare professionals, physicians, surgeons, dentists, podiatrists, psychologists, and veterinarians. So, again, even if you're not covered by the ABC test, the Borrello test is still going to apply, and it's just really a different set of questions.
Sure. Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Ruthie, thank you for joining us. I hope we've raised more answers than questions. I think we left you with a lot of gray area, but the fact is I think this is going to be, for at least for a while, very fact-driven, very complex.
And sorted out in the courts.
Or in arbitration.
And legislation to come, which has been promised.
That's right. Yeah, we were fully expecting ballot initiatives to hit the airwaves here in early 2020 and to be on the ballot in the November election.
But so far, I'm surprised at just how few people have been commenting on this and just how little buzz this is getting in the media. Have we seen it yet? Have the businesses really been adjusting to it yet?
Some more than others. I think, you know, we see a lot of businesses who are concerned about it, who are talking to counsel about, you know, is there something they need to do to shore up the relationships that they have with these individuals, you know, and if they don't, what are the risks? So, and I think those are good questions for any business to ask, you know, what are the risks and rewards of certain courses of action, and the relationship you have with those who perform services for you. I think it's really a good question, and it's all going to, you know, I think be driven by the details as well as the relationships along the lines of the ABC test.
Here in the Bay Area, we hear a lot, probably more of this than most of the rest of the state, because we have some pretty big players local, such as Lyft and Uber, and they're doing a bit of muscle flexing. They suggest some next moves of theirs to counter this. But for the most part, in the rest of the state, in other industries, is it getting that level of airplay?
I think it is in certain industries. I know that with regard to trucking, it has received a huge amount of attention. I'm in Southern California with much of my work, and in the ports, much as you've had in the Port of Oakland, and in some other areas, there have been issues involving truck drivers who perhaps perform work exclusively for one company or two companies, whatever that might be, or you know, perhaps they financed their truck through a certain business that claims that these individuals are independent contractors. There are issues that are popping up, and definitely you know, trucking is one of them.
Yeah, I could see it coming up in a number of different industries. But it's important to remember that for the biggest industries and the ones that are flexing their muscles and actually flouting what I think is a pretty clear directive, not only from the California Supreme Court, but then again by the legislature and the governor in signing Assembly Bill 5, that those companies are largely immunized from lawsuits based on their forced arbitration agreements. So I'd be remiss to not mention the fact that, for the most part, large companies have really exploited their ability to force workers into individual arbitrations, and that ability keeps this below radar and a little bit sub rosa. When the decisions to begin to come down that will force companies through the courts to reclassify their workers, that's when I think you'll see an uptick in terms of the press that comes that follows on what should have already been done.
I think that's true. Unless you've been in the battles with litigation already, you may want businesses may want to sit tight and see what happens. The businesses that have been through these issues are very possibly going to be more attuned to what they want or need to do. And I think that, yeah, it can vary a lot. In an area that is developing, where you may see more changes to the rules, some businesses may want to sit back. But I think when you look at court decisions that are you know, coming down, there was one that just came down involving a transit district in Southern California saying the impact of the Dynamics ABC test is retroactive. I think it's an impetus to move forward a little quicker.
So one of the things that I always look at when I look at a potential for a paradigm change, and I'm getting the sense that things haven't really changed that much yet, but one of the things I look to is who are the winners and who are the losers. And some of the things that might not be as obvious are what happens to artists. For example, the young recording artist who doesn't have a record label, so they have some friends come over and lay down tracks so they can send it up on the internet, maybe get noticed, maybe get something going. And all of a sudden, the specter that these friends that came to lay down a couple tracks are actually employees. Is that a big concern? I don't mean just that one example, but people like that are going to be similarly affected.
Perhaps freelance news reporters who give an employer some flexibility as to how many reporters they're going to have on staff at any particular time. Hairdressers, court reporters.
Well, we've represented reporters, actually, and I just suggest that if you are, and as somebody who was a freelance writer, when you have a regular gig, to use the vernacular, depending on how regular it is, you do graduate from an independent contractor to an employee. And I think that's, you know, I'm sympathetic to the sort of creative pursuits and the idea that we need to recognize that artists, for example, are not likely to fit into a traditional mold. But I just want to sort of ground the conversation back in the social good that comes with being an employer and an employee relationship.
That's what I wanted to touch upon. And it wasn't until we were at the break at the half hour that I remembered that my first job was as an independent contractor delivering newspapers. But, you know, I wasn't saving for retirement. I was covered under my parents' health insurance if I got hurt. It was a fine job for a 15-year-old, but it seems like we now have thousands of workers who are not protected if they're injured. They may not be putting money away towards retirement. They may or may not be purchasing health insurance for themselves. And those are all costs that could be shifted to us, the taxpayers, if something goes wrong.
Well, there's no question that they're being shifted to us. I mean, these are all externalities, and they're being facilitated by the law. And I think the ABC test and what I hope is a paradigm shift in bringing workers back into the fold as employees addresses a lot of these concerns and internalizes these costs and they where they should be borne, which is in by the employer. I mean, I say that as an employer myself and fully aware that it's not a coincidence that these gig economy jobs have really flourished in an environment and in an economy where workers are that much more marginalized, the income and wealth disparities are that much more pronounced than they have been in 45 years, and these workers are working gig jobs, and they are not, I can assure you, they are not paying for health insurance. They are not saving for retirement. They are living paycheck to paycheck, and it's important that we always ask ourselves, you know, as we take advantage of these innovations, and I'm happy to call them innovations because I think many of the technologies that have been brought to bear really are innovations. But there's a reason why somebody's doing a $6 delivery, right? I mean, they're getting in a car, they're spending money on gas, they're putting miles on their vehicle to deliver a pint of ice cream or a scoop of ice cream. And oftentimes the delivery is more expensive than the good being purchased. And there's a reason why there's somebody there to do it, and it's fundamentally not because of flexibility. It's being driven by economic need and, frankly, by desperation. And I think we need to be mindful of that as we consider what the goods are when it comes to the employer-employee relationship.
Yeah, there's definitely been a shifting of cost, and you know, while I think many businesses that look to a model where they consider the workers to be independent contractors, do so, and perhaps believe that they have generated more profit in doing so, there are issues that these businesses need to be mindful of. And when I say issues, I mean risks, because as the likelihood of an alleged independent contractor being an employee increases, we're talking about wage and hour liability, overtime, benefits that have been denied, workers' compensation benefits that have been denied. As I see in my practice occasionally, there are issues where a labor union is trying to organize these workers and is precluded from doing so because of the issue of classification. And that is an issue which it can arise in a number of forums, courts, administrative agencies, and it's one that, is it worth the cost to that business to incur to go forth with that business model? I think that it's a question that comes up repeatedly with different businesses, and of course the details vary from one to the next. But the people who are doing the work often are paid on a basis other than your traditional wages and based upon hours worked. And there are corners cut compared to the traditional employee relationship in framing it a different way.
I want to appreciate how you framed that, Tom. And to me, it is I frame it from the employee's perspective in the following way. What the employer sees as a liability, a workers' rights attorney sees as a protection, and the protections that are afforded to workers who have employee status are really essential to the social fabric. For example, workers who are employees have the protection of California's anti-discrimination laws. Independent contractors don't have those same protections. They're protected if they're injured at work. They get reimbursement for employment-related expenses. These are all protections that are essential to the employer-employee relationship, and those protections evaporate. Now, you know, Rob has identified a long-term consequence, and those chickens will come home to roost when this generation of independent contractors reaches retirement age. And frankly, many of them never will reach a retirement age because they won't be able to stop working because they don't have savings. And that's an essential feature of you know, the employment relationship. And it's a reason why historically work has been rooted in that tradition and not as an independent contractor situation that allows these protections to go away and allows these long-term consequences really to be sort of put off.
I know none of us here are tax attorneys, but I had a question about taxes. I mean, I'm an employer, and I know that when my employees receive their paychecks, taxes are taken out, but I know I'm also paying some taxes on their behalf. So are these independent contractors not making as much sort of take home because they're responsible for more tax?
In theory, an independent contractor is his or her own business, and the hiring entity typically takes the position that the tax liability is on the individual. So it's often a subject of payroll tax audits and payroll tax claims by, let's say, the Employment Development Department of the state of California. You know, many times there are disputes, litigated disputes over those sorts of issues. So, there is a lack of, or I would say a tendency not to to pay taxes that you would find in the typical employer-employee relationship.
Let me turn it to Sherry in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm a visual artist and often an art teacher for a variety of ages all over the city. And I've found that there are a lot of things that I don't think regular people are so aware of this, and that's that artists are asked to be independent contractors to come in and teach children, seniors, all this, you know, even at the public schools, after-school programs, what have you. And they're asked to go there specific hours. You're working with people, especially young children, who you often will get, you know, illnesses from or sicknesses, and you're not given any protections, like no sick days. You have to do all your own taxes. Plus, they'll say, oh, if you get, if you order supplies, we will reimburse you for the supplies, but they don't reimburse you for the time it takes you to order the supplies and deliver the supplies. And, of course, you need a vehicle to bring the supplies, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of hidden costs that you have as the teacher, and yet you don't get the benefits and protection that you are discussing tonight that I'm really looking forward to. But I wanted to ask you, because in a couple of situations when I have raised the issue to some of the people that I was working for, I would say this sounds more like an employer-employee relationship. Especially with the hours that and the control that you're, you know, putting on me, even with the old rules. And I just lost the job then. There was no way that they would. And you know, and when you go to try to get someone to represent you, it's so expensive. I mean, you can't find an attorney for a small job to, you know, try to. And then when I've done my taxes at the end of the year, some people don't turn in the 1099 for me. And so I'm just turning it in the hours anyway, but there's no record. They don't keep a record that I've worked for them either. So anyway, I just wanted to raise those things for the discussion.
Thank you, Sherry. You know, one of the things we didn't get to, part of the outline we had set up for tonight's show, which is a bit further ahead than we're going to get tonight, are some of the arguments that were advanced for and against these changes, both whether it's the companies who want the flexibility and innovation, or the arguments of the workers who need the protection of the law, the safety, reimbursement of their expenses. You practically read from our outline and you hit it perfectly. We're not going to have time to really get into a big discussion of that tonight because we only have a moment or two left. But I would like to take the, you know, go a little bit further with this than we're going to have time to tonight. And I would hope that both of you can come back. And Rob, that I hope you will join as well. I hope we can continue this show.
For sure. Happy to do that.
Yeah, likewise.
We're getting near the top of the hour, and I'd like to give each of you a minute or 1 to 2 minutes for any closing thoughts you have, anything you want to say to summarize. Chris, you want to start?
Sure. The way I always think about this is about the psychology of a poker chip or of a gaming chip in a casino. There's a reason why the casinos use chips as opposed to letting people gamble with cash. And I think the same principle applies here. It's easy to sort of forget what it is you're actually spending when you have something that is an abstraction. And in much the same way, I think the independent contractor relationship represents that kind of abstraction because so many of the costs are hidden. So to Rob's question about taxes and the caller's question about the hidden expenses, these are all things that are less obvious to workers, especially, for example, healthy workers, workers who manage to avoid dangerous work conditions, or workers, independent contractors or employees, who manage to avoid hostile work environments. But when those conditions arise, that's when the protections are the most important. And that's why I think it's essential that we keep in mind that this is not a poker chip. This is not a chip that we can sort of lose sight of and try to keep abstract. We have to remember the concrete reasons that workers need the rights and protections of the law.
Tom?
These are issues which can arise in a variety of businesses. I think with established businesses, they know the lay of the land a little better. They know the boundaries and are going to be less inclined to cross them. They're going to know an independent contractor is, from the plumbing example, rather than someone who's performing the services that your business sets out to perform. I think that as we see new businesses emerge, we certainly want to cultivate an environment in which people come up with new ideas, new models. But I think it's important that people who are on the cutting edge, they need to look at the law. They need to pay attention to, you know, what the rules are. And I think it's common that businesses will want to stretch the limits. They'll want to see how far can they go to do something that they view as new and innovative. But it's going to be important to, you know, look back at the past examples. I think many times the new business people, the innovators have not done so. And I think it's also important to really develop better communication on these issues generally. One thing that has stuck out in all of these issues that I've handled is a real dichotomy, because businesses look at these issues as business model issues. And on the other side, the employees look at these as almost civil rights issues, the right to be treated with a certain dignity and certain benefits.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight's been the reshaping of the gig economy. Co-hosting the show with me tonight, Rob Wyman. In the studio with Rob and I tonight, our guests, labor and employment attorneys, Thomas Lenz, a partner at Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, Romo in Pasadena, California, and Christian Schreiber, partner at Olivier Schreiber and Chow in San Francisco. Chris, Tom, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights, where we'll be looking into the nuts and bolts of the congressional investigations and the possibility of impeachment. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. For Rob Wyman, production assistant Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfvar.org for more information.